Prince Remembered from The Current.
This is Jay Gabler from The Current's local music team. Minneapolis artist Peyton Scott Russell first encountered Prince in the 1990s when Peyton showed work at the Glam Slam nightclub, a downtown Minneapolis spot that Prince owned and where he frequently performed. Peyton also worked at Paisley Park. Among other things, he helped to decorate Paisley Park for Prince's 1996 wedding reception. And when Prince died last year, Peyton was moved to cover Prince's First Avenue star in gold leaf. As the one-year anniversary of Prince's death approaches, Peyton has brought his Glam Slam pieces out of storage, and he plans to display them at an April 21st event at his Casket Arts studio. There are details about that at thecurrent.org. Last week, Peyton welcomed me into his Northeast Minneapolis studio to talk about his long and complicated history with Prince and to share the story of gilding Prince's star, which created an instant sensation. So before we talk about Prince, let's talk about you. So you grew up around here.
Yes, pretty much born and raised in Minneapolis. I've lived in all different sides of the city, from Prospect Park to South Minneapolis to North Minneapolis. Lived in New Richmond, Wisconsin in middle school years. So I kind of bounced around a little bit, you know. Graduated from high school, late 80s, moved to Chicago. Was there for about 6 or 7 years, came back to Minneapolis. Hardcore into the arts, then moved to South Carolina. Now I'm back again. So pretty much, you know, very itinerant, you know.
Yeah. So you're based here in Northeast Minneapolis, and you're now primarily known as a graffiti writer and a teacher as well.
Pretty much. It's one of the things in my artistic arsenal that I'm very passionate about, you know, is graffiti art and teaching.
Yeah. So, tell me about how you first took a special interest in Prince. I understand you were in Chicago at the time.
Yeah, so, you know, living here, I've seen him a bunch of times, you know, when his first couple albums coming out. There was the buzz around town, and I had actually seen him at the Roller Gardens, you know, a few times, and everybody's, hey, man, that's Prince. He's got that album out. And so, you know, I didn't really take a whole lot of notice, you know, to him at the time, and getting into high school in 84 when Purple Rain came out. Before that, you know, people were really into the Controversy and 1999, and of course, you know, I loved it all, but I wasn't like, you know, I wasn't like a fan. You know, I was into hip-hop was new, it was coming out. I was a b-boy, you know, trying to learn breakdancing, getting into graffiti, so that was my scene. And of course, graduating, you know, in 87, I moved to Chicago. And so people found out I was from here, and there was a lot of people, oh, do you know Prince? Have you ever seen him? And I kept getting those questions. And so Sign of the Times was out. And I remember when I first listened to that album, I didn't like it. You know, it just took a while, you know, for me. But I couldn't stop listening to it, which was weird. I didn't quite like it, but I couldn't turn it off. I just kept playing it and playing it, playing it, and it just kind of slowly grew on me. And I just started hearing deeper things in it, and that was the album that kind of hooked me. And then it's my favorite album out of the whole collection, as it is most people's. And then I actually went back and started listening to Around the World in a Day. And that's, you know, that album and Sign of the Times are kind of my two favorites. And then Parade kind of mixes in there. But right about 88, 89 is when I really fell into it, you know, in Chicago, and saw the people in Chicago helped me see a different side of it, you know. And then I started trying to relive, and I remember when I saw him here, I saw him in Uptown, and, you know, this, and remembered all the sightings that I would see him. And so I started collecting bootlegs, you know, trying to find all the stuff. And that's when I started digging deeper and started hearing all this music that you don't hear. And that's when I was like, wow, this guy is different, you know, and just there's something about it. He's, you know, I always call him the wizard, and he makes spells. And if you fall into that spell, it's like you're in that. And so then I was on this crusade, and then I would come home for visits, and then I would be, you know, calling people and trying to find out the avenues, you know, and, you know, Paisley Park was opening, and you know, I wanted to get in there some kind of way. And it was the early 90s that I had an opportunity to come back for some art stuff, and And I ran into one or two people, and I don't really remember how it happened, but somebody, there was a guy that was curating work for Glam Slam, and I ended up meeting him, and he said, well, show me some work. I could maybe get you a show on Glam Slam. So this was, I forget what, maybe 92 at the time. At one point I came back with a portfolio of stuff, and it was kind of similar to what you're seeing here. And he immediately said, okay, you're in, you know, yeah. I'll give you a show.
Yeah. So for the benefit of people who are listening and can't see what we're looking at, how would you describe this work that we're looking at right now?
Well, this particular work was created pretty much specifically for the club. Because once I got in there, I took measurements of the walls. The work had to be large so it could stand out. You know, a few celebrity faces that were popular then that I was kind of focusing on. And then I just tried to make things that were like ethereal and outer body experiences and, you know, spiritual kind of awakenings and, you know, things that had to deal with water. And so that was, you know, I was just kind of, you know, making an aesthetic for the club. And so the curator kept saying, well, you know, I love all these, but they have to be approved.
Right.
You know.
And so just to clarify, we're looking at some large format pieces here. Work on paper, screen printing.
Yes.
In sort of different colors. I'm seeing Michael Jordan there, Prince.
Cindy Crawford, Jimi Hendrix. You know, I was way into Jimi Hendrix kind of even before I got into Prince. And I knew there was some influence there, so I definitely wanted to do something there. But yeah, these larger underwater scenes, you know, just kind of real surreal and symbolic.
Yeah, and so if I was trying to describe this to someone, they might like look at it and think, well, I see Andy Warhol there, but with kind of a 90s twist. Does that seem right?
Yep, I had a lot of influence from Warhol being a printer. I studied his work, the simplicity of it. I'm a little bit more detailed oriented. I like artsy flair and this and that, but I like the simple parts of Warhol, and so there was a lot of that, you know, influence in the work for sure.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm sorry, you were saying, so you're sort of trying to shape the aesthetic of the club.
Yeah. So I wasn't the only artist. There were, you know, it was rotating artists. So when I got the opportunity, I just tried to infuse myself into what that might be, what people might want to see, and that's kind of where this most of the stuff had come from. And so I had my date, and I created all the stuff, brought it in, and the curator was there, and he just loved it all. He's like, okay, hang it all, you know, but just be prepared, you know, you might have to adjust a few things here and there. Fine. Yeah. So I hung the entire show, and Prince walked in. Like, when I was done, I was kind of walking around admiring the thing, making sure the frames were straight, and, you know, and then he comes in, and it was like the first time I had seen him since I was into him now. You know, I'm like, oh my God, there he is. You know, he's looking at my stuff. And he walks around, you know, a good 15 minutes. He stopped at each piece, walked all around, and then he stopped at his piece, the Afro, 1970, you know, Robert, photograph. I got that.
So, from this is a piece sort of taken from the iconic photograph of Prince in front of the Schmidt Music mural wall in downtown Minneapolis, and you just sort of isolated his face from that and blew it up very large. I'm seeing in sort of like some purples and blues and yellows, reds there,
some browns, again in a very Warhol aesthetic, you know, but lots of drips and like spilling paint, which I really like to do.
So Prince stops and sees this.
He looked at that for quite a while, and then he walked out. And about 5 minutes later, the assistant manager came out, and she said, this piece has to come down. And I was like, what? That's like the piece. And he's like, it's the Afro piece. He's not into that at the moment. It's an old photo. It's just, it hasn't been approved, so you have to remove that. So I was heartbroken, obviously, out of all the pieces, you know, he X's that one. And but the assistant manager, she said, I want it. So how much would you sell it to me for? So it was a bittersweet thing. I sold the piece to her, but I couldn't exhibit it. And so it came down, and we filled it with another piece. And up until last year, I haven't shown that since. You know, it went up for, what, I don't know, 30 minutes maybe. And then it came, I sold it, it came down, and then it's been in storage ever since last year. And I had two exhibits, Parkway Theater. It went up in Parkway Theater, and then an exhibit at U-Rock over North Minneapolis on Plymouth. And so, and then it'll be shown again during this exhibition.
Yeah. So what was the scene at Glam Slam like back then?
It was a club. You know, it was a nightclub. And I was in my younger 20s, so it was my first time going out and, you know, experiencing club life and, you know, trying to be grown and, you know, experiencing all of that. And Glam Slam wasn't anything crazy or over the top. You know, Paisley Park was, and we can get into that in a little bit. But Glam Slam was just a nightclub, and so I spent a lot of time there. My work was there. Well, funny story, if I can go into this piece.
Sure.
So, one of the nights, it was after the opening reception. We're there, and they have a back room. Oh, actually, I think it was maybe my second or third show up there, because I started rotating work there.
Okay.
And I got into the back lounge area, the VIP of the VIP upstairs. And so I had artwork back there. And in my mind, I'm thinking, you know, I'm in here. I'm in, you know. So Prince comes in. He's sitting on the couch. And I carried a portfolio with me, an 8x10 book of photographs of other work that wasn't hanging at the time. So he's sitting on the couch, and I just said, you know, I'm going to go over and present myself and show him my portfolio. So I walk over to him, and I'm like, hey, man, how you doing? This is my art, you know. Thanks for the opportunity. You know, are you interested in looking at my other stuff? And I opened the book and laid it on the table in front of him. He sucking on a lollipop. He bends over. He starts flipping through the pages of the book. And I'm like, all right, he's looking at my stuff. All of a sudden, I'm in a full Nelson. And I got swung around, and, you know, I'm totally confused. I don't know. I thought something was going down. You know, whoa, what's going on in the club? And so the bodyguard is like, what are you doing? You know, you can't be doing that. You know, you can't talk to him, and you can't approach him like that. You need to get approval for that. And he said, you have to leave. And I'm like, what? This is, my art is in here. This is, you know, one of my exhibitions, and how are you going to kick me out of my own show? And so I sat there and I argued for a while. The other bouncers came around, and you know, Prince didn't say anything. He just was like looking at the whole scene, and the guard grabbed my portfolio, gave it to me, and he's like, you have to leave. He said, you can come back, but you crossed the line, and tonight you have to leave. And I was just dumbfounded. I just didn't know what was up with that, you know. I didn't do anything. I just showed him my art, and then I got put in a full Nelson and was kicked out. Yeah. And so I'm standing outside just totally perplexed and didn't know what happened. It was just that quick. And you know, I came back like the next night, and, you know, and then people were telling me, like, yeah, there's kind of rules here. You know, he's a different guy. You just can't do that. Even though you're there, you're in VIP, you're back there, you know, there's a separation that you have to adhere to. And so I was like, okay, all right. You know, still a little embarrassed about the whole thing. And yeah, so that was like my first real encounter of what that was like. And a lot of other things happened after that as well. You know, he actually would follow me in the club. You know, I tested it one time. You know, I'd be sitting at the railing, and he'd come within maybe 15 or 20 feet, you know, on the railing next to me, and then I would move to the other side, and then he'd come over to the other side. And then I'd go back again, and he'd come back. And I did that like three or four times, and like playing this game, this cat and mouse game. And I actually tried to approach him again, you know, and then the guard stepped in front of me. What are you doing? And I'm like, oh, I just want to talk. Not here, back up, you know. And then he would give me like a little side look, you know, and then he left. And that was another time. Then there was some other smaller times too. You know, I ended up working at Paisley Park for a while, and
So sort of clarify that transition. Yep. So you're showing your work at Glam Slam, yep, throughout a period of years in the 90s?
Yeah, from about 93 was the first show. And this is when I get a little confused. Because I rotated work. I didn't have like full out exhibitions, but I would rotate one or two pieces, things would adjust, I'd bring old pieces back, mm-hmm. and it was kind of rotating. Other artists were showing work, and so it was in and out.
Did you have a sense that like that Prince was bringing artists in to show their work to sort of like support artists in the community, or were they just like looking for something to hang on the walls?
I think they were just looking for something to hang on the walls, just something that was interesting and you know, local, yeah. right? And I never got a sense that he actually was supporting the artistic community. You know, I didn't feel that. I just felt that they were decorating the club.
Okay.
And this, you know, it for me, it ended about 95, maybe 96. It was a period like there was a transition. I took the work down. Some other work had been shown. And all of a sudden, it was The Quest. And it was like, and I get confused whether that was 95 or 96 that kind of happened. And it might even been one or two years later. I mean, I look at the date on the work, and most of it is from 93 to 95, and I have a couple pieces that's 96. Like, I just discovered, you know, I'm looking at the date. And I thought, okay, maybe I did have some stuff there in 96. But then it changed into The Quest, and most of this work ended up going to the Rogue Supper Club. So I was one of the featured artists at the Rogue, and then that closed, and then I started showing work at the Lounge. Or was it the Living Room? The Lounge. Yeah, one of those. So, yeah, that was that whole kind of mid to late 90s time.
Yeah. And so then what was your first experience at Paisley Park?
I'd been going up there for the after parties, you know, the little after sets. And a friend of mine, we split a warehouse, an upstairs warehouse. And she had one half of it. I had the other half. And I subleased my space from her. And she was a scenic artist, and she worked on several movies. If you remember that time in the 90s when Minneapolis was kind of being set up for the new Hollywood, well, she was in with all of that. And so she would hire me to work on these scenic movies. I worked on Beautiful Girls, and there was one more, I can't remember. Maybe it was Jingle All the Way. Anyway, She was doing that, so then she got hired at Paisley Park to work on the reception for the wedding with him and Maite.
And this would have been,
I think, 96?
Yeah.
Valentine's Day of 96. And so so she called me up and said, hey, you know, I know you're really into this. I got an opportunity for you to work at Paisley Park. We're going to decorate the entire place. It's going to take about 3 weeks, you know, maybe longer. You should come on in. So, of course, you know, I was just Google-eyed. And, you know, right away she was like, you got to keep that under control. Because if you start freaking out, you're gone. So I'm like, okay, I got it. You know, I've already kind of been down this road before, so I understand. So we started. And, you know, I was one of the low guys. I was, you know, the grunt. You know, I painted walls. I took out the trash. I hauled wood, you know. You know, I just did the heavy lifting.
Yeah. Now, this was before Paisley Park was redecorated, which I know happened a little bit later in the 90s, how did it look different from how it looks today? Have you been out there recently?
No, I have not.
Okay.
Because when I left it, I left it.
Yeah.
When I left, I was done.
Okay.
I was kind of fed up with some of the stuff that had happened. And,
okay.
When I left, I kind of didn't look back until last year,
yeah.
which was really odd.
Yeah. So how would you describe the aesthetic of Paisley Park at that time?
So, You would enter into a different space. I swear he had like subliminal music going on. He was probably pumping oxygen in there because it was different. Like the air was different. You'd walk in there and you just really felt like you went somewhere else. And when you would leave, I remember every time I would walk out of the doors, I would get like this different air. Like, oh, I'm back on Earth. You know, and I would leave and I had to kind of get my head right again. And, you know, the colors and the lights and everything that was going on there, it was just really surreal. And so even working there, there's no windows, right? The windows are really weird. So you kind of don't know once you get into the hours, you know what time it is, but you kind of forget, you know, and you're working 3, 4 o'clock, 5, 6, you know, sometimes you're getting out at 3 in the afternoon, 9 in the morning. It kind of didn't matter. You'd get a call at 2 o'clock. hey, we got to come in and, you know, do something on the sound stage. And, you know, so the hours kind of didn't matter. It was just carte blanche open. It just felt really strange.
And so you were there working on this sort of redecoration for the reception for the planned wedding.
Yep.
Yeah. And it was a pretty significant project then. It was going to take a team of people weeks to complete this.
Yeah. There was a big crew of us.
Yeah. So what were some of the big things that were being done?
I remember some of the specific projects that I worked on. So Dolphin was out at the time, the song. So we made this fountain with a dolphin. It had moss on it. And that was pretty big. Most of it was styrofoam. Because again, Kay, she knew how to take styrofoam and make it look like marble or expensive wood, you know, with these faux paintings. And she taught me a lot of that stuff too. So we take these cheap materials and then make them look like really extravagant, expensive, hard granite things. So one of the things was a fountain. Lots of symbols, right? The glyph, those are everywhere. Painting walls, different colors. Like we paint walls three or four times in a day, you know, like, hey, we need this black. And I'd paint it black. And then a couple hours, let's see what it looks like in pink. Okay, you know, let's turn it to blue, you know. And that's how the symbols were too. These giant 8-foot glyph symbols, you know, we'd paint them different colors, glitter, you know, different spray paint on them, make them look like clouds, you know, different things like that. I worked on a project, the window. The atrium window, the front window, and I did this huge heart, right? And they gave me these stack of those clear Mylar sheets that they put on spotlights, and so I had a bunch of red ones, and they were like, okay, do like a stained glass thing with like a big giant heart. And I was like, all right. I worked, I don't know, 6 to 8 hours on this thing, and they were 8x10 Mylar sheets, so I had to figure out how to take all these small pieces and put them together into this very large heart format.
Because to clarify, this is 8 inches by 10 inches.
Yes. Yeah. These small 8x10 inch squares. And the windows were, I don't know, those atrium windows, they're huge. You don't know what size those are. But I did it. I completed the heart, and I was really proud of myself.
Just to clarify, these are the windows on top of the atrium or by the doors?
By the doors.
Okay.
Right? Yeah, by the doors. So they're what? Those windows are all the way, you know, they're the whole floor of the... I don't know how big they are.
It's plate glass
pretty large.
Windows,
I mean, I was on ladders hanging the stuff, you know, a little roll of tape. So I finished this project. I was really excited, you know, about it. Super proud. Worked all day on this thing. You know, it was front and center. I was going to see this piece. And I'm getting off the ladder. He's standing right behind me. And I almost, like, stepped on him, basically. Almost ran into him. And, you know, I'm like, whoa, it freaked me out because I didn't know he was there. And I was like, oh, hey, man, how you doing? Didn't say a word. You know, I'm like, what do you think? What do you think? And he just didn't say a word, just kept looking, turns around, walks away. I'm like, all right. You know, 5 minutes later, Kay comes up to me and she says, the heart looks like it's broken. And right when she said that, it totally did. Because I took these 8x10 Mylar sheets and I made them to look like irregular tiles, but I made these hard points on them. So the heart looked shattered. And once that was pointed out to me, you know, then I couldn't get that out of my mind. And the heart totally looked shattered. As a graffiti writer, graffiti artist, that's one of the techniques that we use, you know, making things look like tiles and using different colors and, you know, cracks and that kind of thing. It's really cool to us. And I think that's where that really came from, but it wasn't flying right there. So we had a big meeting about, you know, what to do. You know, Kay had suggested some things and we were going to, you know, we figured it out. But then I got pulled into a different project. And so they're like, okay, we're going to handle that tomorrow. We're going to get more Mylar sheets and we'll fix it up. So I'd been through the discussion with her, and this was the most interesting encounter I had with Prince. The next day, I get called into one of the spaces, one of the offices, which are down below. There's like 3 or 4 rooms, you know, the main area. They're like little office spaces. And we'd been in there before to discuss things that weren't quite going. Like the Dolphin Fountain had too much moss on it, and we had to take the moss down. And Kay was always in there, and she, you know, she's my boss, and yeah. she was always the one talking.
And what's her last name?
Crop. Okay. Kay Crop. So she was always the one talking, and you know, then she would sometimes relay the message to me and back and forth, and so one of the times I got pulled off alone, and they said, "Hey, need you to go back in the room," and when the phone rings, answer it. So I'm like, "Okay," you know, I go back there, and I'm the only one back there, and so I'm waiting. I kind of started dozing off a little bit. You know, I was a little tired. It's 10, maybe 15 minutes, and so Prince walks in. I'm like, wow.
In the flesh.
Yeah. At me and him in this room alone, you know. He sits down. As you are, he kind of turns his back to me. You know, he kind of sits like this. You know, he's kind of has his back to me. And you know, I immediately woke up, and I'm like, wow. Then the phone rings. Right? The phone starts ringing. It's a black phone, the square, old-style phone. You know, touch, push-button phone. And the phone is ringing, but now he's in the room. So I'm like, wow, I'm not going to answer the phone. You know, now he's in the room now. So
you're at Paisley Park. The phone rings.
Right.
Prince is there. You're, yeah.
So I'm just, it's ringing and ringing and ringing and ringing and ringing. He looks over at me and he looks down at the phone. He looks back up at me like, answer the phone. He didn't say anything though. So I'm like, oh, so I answer the phone. Now, I don't remember this guy's name, but he was Kay's boss. And during these discussions, he would talk to Kay. Kay would talk to me, right? Prince would talk to this, whoever this guy was. Well, it was him. And he had been in the meetings before, but now he was in Houston, somewhere in Texas. And he's like, hey, you know, we got a problem with the heart. We got to change it. It looks, you know, and I'm like, yeah, I kind of already been through this, you know. He said, well, what are your suggestions? What are you going to do? And so we kind of talked it through how we were going to change it a little bit. And then I asked a question about, you know, because they wanted purple outline and whatever it was. And so I asked a question, and the guy said, okay, hold on, hang the phone up. Hung up the phone, and this other phone rings. Prince pulls his gold phone out. And, you know, I didn't really think a whole lot of it at the time, but I just, my first thought was, where'd that phone come from? It was the same phone that was the one on the table, the black one, but it was gold. And he put it on his lap, and he put his hand, his mouth over the phone, and he's kind of whispering on the phone, and he hangs the phone up. And the black phone rings again. And it's the guy, and he's, ah, okay, yeah, we're going to do this, that, and the other. And, you know, and I'm kind of like, all right, I'm communicating through this guy. He's in Houston through these two phones. He's not speaking to me, but he's as close as you are to me now. And so we went back and forth on this conversation, these yes or no questions and answers. We must have spent, I don't know, 20, 15 minutes, 15 to 20 minutes in that room going back and forth like that. And I actually, right at the end, was playing the game as well, because I would deliberately ask a yes or no question to make it go through the channels. So we got to the end of it, and I'm on the phone, and then he walks out. And I'm still on the phone and kind of cleaning up whatever. And he leaves the phone on the chair. And so the gold phone. Yeah. So I hang the phone up, and I just look at the phone, and I'm looking at it. Now, remember, I had been in that room 10 or 15 minutes prior. There was no phone. You would have noticed the gold phone sitting there. And when he walked in, I might have been so starstruck, I didn't see him with the phone. But I could swear to you, I thought about these over the years. He did not have a phone with him. I don't know where that phone came from. You know, he walked in and I was half sleeping. So that, you know, he might have had it behind his back or whatever, but he comes in and he sits down and I'm kind of checking him out. I didn't see no phone. And so I don't know where that phone came from. I told a lot of people that, and you know, some people are like, yeah, you know, some people are like, whatever, that's BS. And some people will tell me there's a lot of interesting stories like that. He has hundreds of them. You know, different people that he would play games with and set things up like that. So that was my most interesting encounter there. There were smaller ones here and there. It got to the point, you know, I'm an artist, not a musician, and I was kind of trying to work on my own thing. And after a few years, I got a little tired of, you know, like going out and being in the scene and then being in Paisley Park and being around the circles, but really not feeling included. And the last time I was there, a friend of mine that I hung out with, John Bevel, he's a clothing designer. He's no longer here. He passed away in 2004. He was like my best friend. You know, he was the guy that we went to the Paisley Park together. We were always at Glam Slam, the Quest, and we were just in that circle together. And we would go to the after parties, and you know, you'd get frisked when you would come into the door, and then you'd be in the party. And then,
so these people, when you say sorry, after parties, they're after parties at Paisley Park.
Paisley Park.
After shows,
yes,
at Glam Slam.
Yeah. Or sometimes he would just throw a party, and then you would be in the channels. You would get a message, right? Somebody would get a message and say, "Hey, Paisley Park tonight," and then everybody show up, and you knew that was a late night. You'd getting out at 6, 7, 8, sometimes 9 o'clock. You know, he wouldn't get on till 2, 3 o'clock,
and in the morning.
Yep, and then he'd play 3, 4 hours or whatever. So John and I we were doing that, but it right at the end of it, I would get frisked a lot at the door, and then once I was in there, I would get pulled off to the side and frisked again. There was one time I got frisked 3 times, pulled off into those rooms, and I just looked at the guard and I was just like, "What is going on? I'm already in here. You guys know I don't have any recording devices." And they said, "We're just doing what we're told. We just have to spend time with you." You know, and I'm just like, ugh. You know, it was really kind of disturbing and, you know, kind of ruining the flow of the night. And I was getting fed up with it, you know, just always being pulled off, getting frisked, getting looked at. "Hey, you got to stand over here for a little while. You know, we need you right here." "Why?" I don't know. "I'm just following orders." I'm like, wow, okay. So the last night I went up there, John and I, we were standing in line. We get pulled off to the side. The whole entire line comes through. We're the only two in the lobby. They close the door and lock it. John is a little more impatient than I was, and he's banging on the door. You know, the guys open the door. "Hey, what's up?" And John's like, "You know, what's going on?" And that's, "Oh, we haven't been told to let you guys in yet." John's like, "Wow, this is really BS." So we're waiting. All of a sudden, everybody in the lobby leaves. They all go in the back. It gets concert starting. Whatever is happening, everybody leaves, and they turn the lights off. Lights got turned off,
and you're locked out.
And we're standing in between the double doors,
like in the vestibule.
Right? Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. And John just screams at the top of his lungs, "F you! This is BS!" You know. And he's like, "Let's go," and I just laughed. And we walked out. And I hadn't been back since. I did go back one other time with a girlfriend of mine. I think this was One Night Alone. Was that 2004?
Okay.
He had a concert at XL.
Yeah, and so that night when you got locked out, that would have still been in the 90s.
Yeah, I think it was 97.
Okay.
That was 97, okay. And I was done.
Yeah, so several years later.
Yep. You know, the girlfriend at the time is now the mother of my kids. And so she wanted to experience that. And so we went to the concert, and then there was an after set after the concert. And I said, "Well, you know, I can call some people and we can get in." And so we went up there, and you know, we stood in line, did the whole channels. We walked in, and I'm a little older now. And so we're in there, and she actually got a chance to see it, and he was doing his thing. It was, you know, 1, 2 o'clock. He hadn't gone on stage yet, and we're tired. You know, and she's like, "Well, you know, I've already seen him. I'm in Paisley Park. I don't really need to see him. I kind of like to go." And I'm like, "Are you sure? You know, it's different. You know, you're gonna hear some different things." And she's like, "No, I'm okay." We left. So she didn't get to see the after set, and that was the last time I was there.
Yeah.
And so we left. And
did you have a sense that anything had changed at Paisley Park between 97 and 2004?
So we went in through the back. They had a tent, and it was like a back door. I'd never gone through that way before. I think my tastes were different. You know, I would remember the time when that I was a little more starstruck, a little bit more into it. And I just remember feeling like I was just standing around waiting for something to happen. And, you know, people were just kind of being there to be there. And, you know, and it just was like not my scene anymore. And so when she wanted to leave, I didn't really argue with that much. And, but I tried to encourage her to stay so she could hear the deeper parts of what he had to offer. Because, you know, if you, those people who never went to Paisley Park and saw that, that underlay of what he had, I mean, that's, you would see the magic. I mean, when people say genius, I mean, that is just an understatement. I mean, when you would go to Paisley Park and you would hear him in his element when he was comfortable, my goodness. I mean, it was just something. It's really hard to explain that. So I wanted her to see that, and I would have sucked it up and stayed the night. But, you know, again, we were tired and we wanted to go. So
yeah,
so we left.
See, you knew a lot of other people who were sort of Paisley Park regulars and, you know, maybe had other their own relationships with Prince. Did you ever get any sense at all of what it might have been that caused his apparent feelings towards you to be so complicated?
I never quite figured it out, but Tommy Barbarella, we became pretty decent friends.
Keyboardist from the New Power Generation.
Yes, yeah. He would say, you know, he always thought that he liked me, but he didn't know how to incorporate me in the thing because I'm a visual artist and, you know, he's with musicians. He knows how to control that. And so Tommy always felt like he didn't quite know how to handle that. And so he could just, you know, I always thought it was his personal thing. I always thought I was the one being selected out and being treated like that. And it wasn't until last year that I figured out that there was so many other people that he treated like that. I just thought it was me, you know. And then all these stories would come out, you know, of all these people explaining these different things that would happen. And I was like, wow, I kind of went through that. So, and that was the only thing that could really put my finger on.
Because you're so, kind of... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I never figured it out.
Because you were kind of being given a hard time, but and yet you were coming back and being hired, in fact. You were working for Paisley Park throughout this time. So not only was he, for the most part, like letting you in, but he was actually, you know, hiring you to work on projects and at the same time kind of almost like teasing you.
Yeah. There. You know, there were times when I just... Because now we're, 20-some years later, and sometimes I wonder, did I dream that? You know, like, Paisley Park was so different. There were times when I actually thought I was dreaming, and, like, is this really happening? Like, he followed me a lot. He would stare at me through plants, and, you know, I could feel him, and I would look around and be like, I feel like somebody's watching me. And then I wouldn't see him for a while, and I would keep looking, and then I'd see him, like, in a plant, like, between the leaves. And then when he would recognize that I could see him, he'd walk away. And I was like, okay, that was weird. Yeah. You know, things like that happened all the time. But he never spoke. He never said hi. He never gestured or anything. And very quick eye contact, you know, and always close proximity, you know. But it was just really strange. It was really strange. So after a while, I just was like, whatever. This is...
Yeah.
So when I left... I like left. I mean, I almost rarely bought any of the new albums. There's a few that I bought, but I kind of stopped listening until he passed. And then when he passed, it took me a while, you know. And at first, you know, the plane, the emergency landing, right? That happened, and I was like, oh, okay. And then when I got the news that he passed, I thought. I was in denial. I didn't believe it at first. I thought it was, you know, a rumor hoax from the plane landing, you know. And, you know, people started talking about it. The news was carrying on. And I was just like, oh, well, that's too bad. And as the day went on, I started remembering certain things. And I started pulling out some of my old material. And I had to dig it out. I had to find it. I didn't know where the stuff was. And I slowly started pulling out some of the music that really, like, had an effect on me. And when I started hearing that stuff again, I had heard it since back then. And I started remembering, I started getting that feeling. And it was like midday on that day, and then I just kind of fell apart. You know, felt like I lost a family member, which was really odd for me, because I'm not a person that's into celebrities. I don't get starstruck. It's, you know, I'm just not impressed by famous folks and, you know, things that they do. Yeah, of course. But Prince is the only one that I've ever, you know, been like, oh, you know. And so I just really felt like I lost like a silent mentor. You know, he just gave me so much inspiration and, you know, passion for doing what I do. And yeah, it was just like his music. There was always slow growth. A lot of times I would listen to some of his stuff and I wouldn't like it right away. And then after a while, it would just grow on me. And these are just songs that are just like a part of me. And then when he passed away, same thing happened. I didn't feel anything right away. And then after a little bit, you know, I was kind of a wreck for a while. So there you have it.
Yeah. Well, and then you decided to give his star on First Avenue's wall a treatment.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I try to keep that under wraps, you know, as long as I could. You know, I think it was a few months, you know, I put it up.
And so just to tell the story of putting it up, you went in dark of night, about 3:30 in the morning, I understand.
Yeah. It was a couple weeks after his passing, because people spent the night, you know, at that star, putting stuff up, notes and flowers. And so I kept going there, checking it, and I just recently started gold leafing in my art. And I learned it from a former student of mine who's now a sign painter, Dan Mattson, you know, Dusty Signs, give a little plug there. So he taught me like some basics about gold leafing, and I was incorporating that into my art. And, you know, I saw all of the pictures and people posting different things around the star, and I'm just like, you know, as a graffiti writer, graffiti artist, you know, I'm gonna gold that thing, you know. So it was about 2 weeks went by. Finally, it died down a little bit really late at night, and I figured 3 o'clock would be perfect, you know. A couple hours, I can get it done. So one night, I made it happen. And it was before the Paul McCartney concert, which I didn't know. I mean, it was kind of a perfect alignment of the stars, because I didn't know it was going to be that much of a big deal. I knew it was going to get noticed, right? I knew it was going to, you know, but I felt it was just going to be another, oh, someone just decorated the star, you know, with the posters and whatnot. But wow, that thing, it was huge. You know, I've seen murals in Europe of that, you know, black background gold star with the font that's on there, that exact replica of that star. So it really carried a lot of weight. And yeah, I mean, it leaked out, of course. You can tell one or two people, then everybody knows. And then I got the article, Minneapolis St. Paul, magazine.
Yeah. Have you ever talked to the staff at First Avenue about it?
No, I did, but not about that specifically.
Yeah.
Because I kind of knew they weren't happy about it. You know, they wanted, you know, I understand. As a graffiti writer, I understand the conundrum of street art and graffiti. Everybody loves it, but there's a layer that people hate because of how it's produced. So I get that. I understand that. So I knew they weren't happy, but it brought a different element to the club with the gold star, the more selfies, the more photos. So it was an enhancement, usually as street art and graffiti is, but you got to get over that hard part of it. And the star started to be damaged. People were picking it and putting stickers on it and then pulling them off, and then gold would come off. And so I somewhat anonymously called them and said, hey, you know, I know the star is getting a little damaged. You know, I'd offer my services to clean it up. So right away they were excited about it. Yeah, we need someone to fix it up. Do you know how to do this? You know, what kind of material is it? Everyone thought it was paint, right? And so, you know, I was like, well, I don't think it's paint, you know.
It's actual 24-karat gold.
Yeah, it's 24-karat gold leaf. And so so we went through these conversations, and we finally got to a point where we were going to do it. And they said, well, we can't pay you. We'll give you tickets for shows and a bar tab. I was like, that is awesome. I'd love that. So they were like, well, send me your website. We can check you out. And I knew right away. I was like, if I send my website, they're going to know. I didn't have anything, any evidence that I did that, but I knew they would link the dots.
Yeah.
Right? So I was like, okay, if I send them my website, they're going to know. So I sent them the website, and then I didn't hear anything. And here we had been in conversation a couple times a day through emails, and then I got ghosted. And then I started messaging them back, hey, you know, are we going to do this? And didn't hear a thing. A couple weeks went by, and I'm like, wow, okay, they're upset. They ghosted me. Maybe even 3 weeks went by. And it's getting late into the summer, and I said, "Hey, if we're gonna do this, there's a weather piece. You know, if it gets too cold, the gold leafing isn't gonna work correctly. We'll have to wait till spring to get that done." So they contacted me, said, "Oh, we've been busy with deadlines. You know, sorry we haven't contacted you back. You know, so when could you do it?" And I was like, "Well, I could do it next week." Okay, come in, and then I didn't hear a thing again from them for a while. It was really strange, and then I get a message from them saying, thanks, but no thanks, we found someone else to do it. So I'm like, okay, I get it, you know, he doesn't cut me out of it, you know, that's cool, I understand. And I'm not sure who did it or how they did it, but I think it's painted now, because the star is like perfect, it's super edged off and really nicely done. You know, it could have a clear coat on it, but I really doubt that it's 24 karat gold. It doesn't have the luster it once had. When I first did it, it was done really well, but the edges were a little, had some texture. It was a little more organic, and it just looked like it had more soul and more spirit to it. Of course, you know, I was doing it from my heart, from my love, and, you know, from that. But now it looks a little sterile. It looks too professionally, perfectly done. You know, not to say that it's bad or anything, but it's just they cleaned it up and it's like permanently gold, but I think it's paint now and not the good stuff. Yeah.
So made you decide to show this work now?
Sarah Savoy contacted me through... okay, now I'm confused. Either it was through the magazine or... I met her at the Parkway Theater Tribute.
Okay. When the New Power Generation.
Yeah. With Julius. And, so she's, you know, she's hugely connected with the circle.
The circle of Prince fans.
Prince fans worldwide, yeah. Right? She's got a blog and, you know, she's, I don't know, a couple million people. So she's pretty famous in that culture. So she contacted me, and she's like, I don't know you, you know, like, you know, I thought I knew everybody, you know. So she knew about that I had shown work at Glam Slam, and she said, well, I'd like to come see that work. Would that be okay? And she knew about the mural, because the mural came out in the magazine. She wanted to, at mural at my studio, she wanted to see that. And so we set up a meeting. She came by, she saw the work, and she just right away was like, we got to show this stuff. You know, let's have an exhibit. And of course, I'm removed from it. I'm doing other things now, and I know how difficult it is setting these up, and it's paperwork, it's got to be framed, it's, you know, it's a whole different process. But she talked me into it and set up things like this. I guess this work is now in September, it's going to go to the R&R auction. The auction that did the two auctions, Prince's stuff.
Okay.
They're doing a third one in September. And I'm now included in that. So this work will be, will go into that. So yeah, I mean, I'm happy that she was able to kind of coax me into this and talk me into it. And it's really fun for me to pull this stuff out. Because again, I haven't seen this work in 20 years. And I had forgotten about it. I knew it was there. But once I pulled it out and really looked at it, I've always been kind of bemoaned with my work, you know, as an artist when I first do it. And it takes like a while. I got to put it away, come back to it for in a year, look at it, and then I go, wow, that was pretty good. I don't know what I was thinking at the time. Maybe I just was too into it at the time, and I couldn't see it. So, but now I lay it out on the table like this, and I'm like, wow, this stuff is pretty special, you know. So I'm really thankful that I'm doing this and being able to exhibit this work. Because this what you see is just a sliver. I mean, I got all these flat files of all of that. I mean, it was a lot of work I created back then. Not all of it got shown. I will be showing some things in this exhibit that was not selected for the club, but it was a part of that time, and I just want to show it just because I like it, and it's an opportunity for me to show a few people that work.
I'm back at the Current now. I just wanted to share a story that Peyton shared with me via email after our conversation. He writes, I didn't mention the one cool thing that Prince did for me. This happened before he turned the lights off on me and John. He sent a bus to pick up my art students for a benefit concert at Paisley Park. I believe it was in 1996, Peyton writes. That was totally awesome. I'm not sure how it all went down and got set up, but a bus came to pick us up with a few others. Winter coats were handed out to the youth with a Prince glyph on the back, and he gave us a private question and answer session. But the adults in the room ruined that by asking dumb questions about Purple Rain or stupid trivial questions. Prince didn't want that, and he said so, but the adults continued on, and he got up and left. The concert was short, too. Not sure why, but he only played like 4 or 6 songs and left. After being there so many times, I knew that was not normal. I'm not sure what was going on, but the gesture was awesome, and the bus brought us back to my studio. Memorable evening.